Welcome to Brighteon Broadcast News for Tuesday, November 7th, 2023. Mike Adams here. Thank you for joining me. There's an alternative explanation for current events in the Middle East. The Israel-Hamas war may be taking place because, well, northern Gaza happens to occupy the space that's needed to build a new canal called the Ben-Gurion Canal. And Ben-Gurion, I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly, he was the first prime minister of Israel. And this canal would connect the Red Sea to the Mediterranean Sea, which is a very big deal if you are familiar with the geography, because currently the only canal that accomplishes anything close to that is the Suez Canal. And the Suez Canal, of course, goes through Egypt. And that means that, you know, Egypt controls the canal. And something like 12% of all the cargo in the world currently passes through the Suez Canal, about 18,000 ships a year, and a much higher percentage of oil for the world passes through the Suez Canal. And remember when a ship got stuck in the Suez Canal a couple years ago? It blocked up the canal, and what that did, the world trade, and, you know, some people thought that was deliberate sabotage. It might have been. I don't know for sure. But the Suez Canal is a choke point for international trade and also for military vessels. So, in fact, recently, just in the last couple of days, the USS Eisenhower aircraft carrier reportedly passed through the Suez Canal and is on its way to the Red Sea. At least that's what was reported. So, strategically, the canal access between the Mediterranean Sea and the Red Sea is absolutely critical for the United States to achieve global domination and the projection of military power, and also to have access to affordable energy, i.e. oil, out of the Middle East. And the Suez Canal right now is not wide enough for more than one ship to be in it in one direction, you know, at one time. In other words, you can't have two ships passing each other going in opposite directions. So the entire Suez Canal is one-way traffic for a while, and then everybody waits, and then they go the other way of traffic, and that's how it works. And it's slow. If you've ever, you know, driven through a construction site where they block all the traffic, and then, you know, they have a lead car that drives one side through and then the other side through, you know, it's slow. Well, that's how the Suez Canal works. Well, the new canal, the Ben-Gurion Canal that has been proposed for Israel, and I'm going to show you this picture of it. As you can see where this red line is, and that line is not exact, by the way. It's a little bit off, but this red line roughly shows where the canal would go, and it would be wide enough for two ships to pass each other, you know, basically two lanes, one lane going each direction. And that means that transiting that canal would be much faster than the Suez Canal, and the amount of revenue that would be earned from that passage would be at least $6 billion a year, maybe as much as $9 or $10 billion a year. Now, if you take a look at this map, actually, let me show you a little different map right here. Well, as you can see from this map, the canal, which is represented, or the proposed canal, represented by the dark blue line, it cuts across southern Israel, and it enters, or it exits Israel to the Mediterranean Sea right at the northern tip of Gaza, the Gaza Strip, right there. So, of course, you know, Gazans, or the Palestinians, well, they happen to be, you know, living in this giant concentration camp right where Israel wants to build this canal. And so, given that this canal is going to be worth many billions of dollars a year, and more importantly, would give the United States military transit powers from the Mediterranean Sea to the Red Sea through a friendly power, that is, a friendly nation, Israel, rather than Egypt, which, by the way, right now is actually pushing back against Israel and pushing back hard. We'll talk about that in a second. But the value of this canal going through Israel to the United States is very, very high. And also for Israel itself, the value is very, very high because it would mean that Israel could begin to build and launch naval vessels along the canal, vessels that could easily show up in the Mediterranean or in the Red Sea, you know, depending on their mood, depending on the day, in other words. And that's a very big deal strategically if you're Israel or if you're the United States. So we're going to talk about this in a little more detail, but notice that it's the northern half of Gaza that is being ordered to be evacuated, the northern half that's being bombed. And it's the northern half of Gaza, that is the area close to where this canal would come out, that is being bulldozed. I mean, first bombed into rubble and then bulldozed to clear the rubble and actually just destroy northern Gaza. They want everybody out of there. Now, of course, in order for Israel to have the excuse to do that, they needed to have Hamas attack Israel, which is why, of course, Netanyahu and the intelligence services ordered the IDF to stand down on October 7th. And you know, Hamas was originally created and funded by Israel or Israeli intelligence services. It's always been, Hamas has been a puppet of the West from its inception. And so Hamas was encouraged to wage that attack so that Israel could react and then bomb northern Gaza, clear everybody out, you know, wipe out that land, claim it, and then begin construction on this canal. At least this is an alternate explanation that has emerged. Now, please keep in mind that there are many different explanations and motivations probably for what's going on. I mean, yesterday in our podcast, we talked about that letter from Albert Pike from, I think, 1871, where he had predicted three world wars and the third world war. And remember, Albert Pike was like a Luciferian 33rd degree Freemason also. So it was all in the service of Lucifer, right? And what that letter said is that the third world war would be a war between Zionism and Islam, and that the goal of that was to see those two wipe each other out while also destroying Christian faith in God, you know, destroying Jerusalem, by the way, in particular, and destroying Judaism because of the destruction of faith that God would protect Israel and so on. And so that's another interpretation of current events where it's a Luciferian agenda to escalate this into World War III and see the destruction of faith so that Lucifer can succeed in his claimed dominion over planet Earth. And, you know, Christians and Jews would be disillusioned and they would turn to Lucifer. You know, at least that's how that explanation goes. And maybe that's exactly the right answer, but it might coexist with many other reasons. One reason could simply be that Netanyahu wants to be seen as the savior of modern Israel, and he wants to achieve a greater Israel that has to, in his view, exterminate all Palestinians, get them all out of Gaza, and also all out of the West Bank as well. And, you know, those efforts are underway as well. I mean, that's the simplest explanation. But this canal, this has been well known for many, many years. I mean, this is, you know, written up in Wikipedia and other websites as well. In fact, let me tell you a little bit more about this canal. Back after Israel was formed, back in 1948, the Suez Canal was not usable by Israel. Israel was restricted from using the canal. And I'm reading this, by the way, from MiddleEastMonitor.com. And then the Arab states blocked all the land trade routes to Israel. Israel could not trade with East Africa or Asia, couldn't import oil from the Persian Gulf, and Israel really had a major crisis at that time. And back in 2021, the ship that got stuck in the Suez Canal, I don't know if you recall this, it was called Ever Given. Ever Given. And again, there were a lot of theories that that ship was intentionally run aground. And I forgot how long that was stuck, but it seems to be like it was a couple of weeks. And it really disrupted global supply chains. So as this website writes, Middle East Monitor, quote, whoever controls the canal, they're talking about the new Ben-Gurion Canal in Israel, the one that's being planned. Whoever controls the canal will have enormous influence over the global supply routes for oil, grain, and shipping. So you see, it's energy and it's food and it's economics. Those three. With Gaza razed to the ground, it would enable the canal planners to cut corners and reduce costs by diverting the canal straight through the middle of Gaza. In other words, it wouldn't have to come out to the north of Gaza. They could just have the canal just cut right through Gaza. So, of course, they need Gaza emptied and destroyed. Oh, and here's the figure. The Suez Canal is worth $9.4 billion a year to Egypt. So there you go. Almost $10 billion a year. That's a lot of money for a canal. And it doesn't cost, you know, nearly that to maintain it. It's a tiny fraction of that to maintain it. Now, it costs a lot to build it. And to build the Ben-Gurion Canal, I think I saw that it was estimated to be anywhere between $16 and $50 billion to build. And it would be actually a couple hundred kilometers long. But that the geography there in that area of Israel is hard rock, so that the walls of the canal would actually be very sturdy, you know, not soft sand or dirt or mud that would slide in and you'd have to dredge it out every day, but rather rock, which would just maintain its shape for the most part. And so once you built it, even if it costs $50 billion, guess what? It pays for itself in 5 years, just in terms of revenues. And $50 billion these days is nothing. I mean, the U.S. sent $110 billion to Ukraine so far. Half of that money could build this whole canal in Israel and give the U.S. and Israel much more control over the Middle East. Again, oil exports, food, military vessels, you know, transit of military vessels, and also more efficient economics for world trade. And more importantly, the U.S. could weaponize access to the canal because, you know, the U.S. has weaponized the dollar. The U.S. has weaponized the SWIFT system. The U.S. wants to weaponize everything. Like, if you don't do what we say, we're going to have sanctions on you. We're going to deny you the use of this, right? So if they had the Ben-Gurion Canal, you can bet the U.S. would try to force the Saudis, you know, get along with us, and then you can use the canal, right? Or other countries in the region. I mean, this is all about control. And in order to get that control, they just have to eliminate, you know, 2.3 million Palestinians, which is exactly what's happening. You know, it's often said, if you want to know who's behind war, follow the money. And that's not always the dominant answer, but very often it is. I mean, in this case, perhaps it really is a holy war. Perhaps it's a war of religious differences. Or perhaps it's a giant prison break because the Palestinian people are living in a giant concentration camp and they are treated, you know, in a disgusting manner, very inhumanely by the Israelis. We'll talk about that. But if you want to follow the money, then you need to know about the Ben-Gurion Canal, because this canal would make a massive difference in terms of economics, in terms of world trade and the speed of trade. In other words, the U.S. could maintain a more efficient supply chains from the Middle East of not just energy, but other things that are manufactured and exported out of the Middle East, including Europe could have easier routes to, let's say, India for export of rice and other grains and so on. And right now the land routes from, let's say, India to Europe, you know, are not efficient. I mean, you can move things by sea for a tiny fraction of what it costs to move them by land. I mean, it's really a fraction. It's like, in many cases, if you do the math, it's something like 1% of the cost to move goods by sea in a container or on a barge in a river, you know, versus moving them on a truck down a road. You know, the cost difference is massive. Now, another website called Frontier India is reporting that Israel plans to build small cities and hotels and restaurants along the canal, basically turn it into a tourist area with nightclubs, you know? I mean, it would be kind of interesting. Oh, here comes an aircraft carrier, you know? Like, wow, look at the lights. You know, here comes World War III. Check it out. And in addition, this canal would be 10 meters deeper than the Suez Canal. So this would allow very large ships to pass through, including ships that have a width of 110 meters. That's wider than a football field, or roughly as wide as a football field. But a ship with the length of 300 meters and a width of 110 meters would be able to pass through this new proposed canal. And you know what that means? It means that, well, potentially larger ships can be constructed to carry more cargo, which means more efficiency in terms of economics, or larger military vessels could be constructed. And also, you know, submarines can go through the canal at a deeper depth because it's 10 meters deeper. And 10 meters, you know, that's a big deal when you're trying not to get, you know, stuck on either as a submarine or a cargo vessel. So this is something that we really need to consider. And here's something from the Defense Department back in 2021. They said this was when the Suez Canal was blocked. They said the Suez Canal is an essential maritime choke point, and the longer the passage is suspended, the more impact it will have on civilian and military transits. However, we have alternate capabilities to mitigate impact and support to our operations in U.S. Central Command's area of responsibility throughout any extended blockage. This was from Rebecca Roberich, public affairs officer with the U.S. Naval Forces Central Command. All right. Now, here's something else you need to know. How do you dig a canal that's almost 200 kilometers long through areas that some of which are rocky mountains? You know, you have to excavate mountains. I mean, this would be a massive project. How do you do that? Well, there was a plan that was revealed in 1994 that was mentioned in a memo from the Lawrence Livermore Patriot Labs in the United States. And this proposal said that the best way to build this canal would be, it would involve, or start with, 520 nuclear blasts across Israel. So, yeah, right. So if you think about, okay, how do you move mountains? You detonate them. Well, that's a lot of TNT to start detonating mountains, and who knows, you know, how high these mountains are above sea level. I mean, you'd have to use maybe more TNT than there is in the whole world. And so they've decided to use nuclear blasts. Well, if you're going to use nuclear blasts to excavate and move mountains to build a canal, which, by the way, just as a side note, isn't it crazy what our world leaders will do for money and power and profit? Like anything. Let's 500 nuclear blasts. Okay. You know, what about the fallout? What about the radiation? And what about the groundwater supply? You know, I mean, what about the winds blowing cesium to neighboring countries? You can imagine the ecological consequences of this would be just horrendous. But again, anything for the canal, right? Anything for Israel. But the fact that Palestinians are there in Gaza and that the excavation would be taking place right next to Gaza would mean that Israel would be setting off nukes right next to the Palestinians. Now, again, you can imagine the outcry that this would cause. And so it's in Israel's view, it's so much better to just move all the Palestinians out first. And then they won't complain when we nuke what used to be, you know, their neighborhoods. And this is why I think one of Israel's ministers, who was suspended by Netanyahu, said a couple days ago that maybe we should just nuke Gaza. What was he, the cultural minister, I think? It's like, really? You think we should nuke Gaza? Well, that was actually an echo of reality, because the bigger plan is to nuke Gaza as a form of excavation to build the canal through Gaza so that Israel and the United States can exert more power in the Middle East. All making sense now? This is the economic plan. I mean, the economic domination plan. Anything for money. Let me show you this NASA satellite photo that I think will even explain this better. All right, check out this photo. Now, the giant blob of water in the the lower center or bottom right of this photo is, of course, the Red Sea. And then if you think about the water here as being like rabbit ears, like if the Red Sea is the head of a rabbit, and then it's got two rabbit ears. The rabbit ear on the left, that is the Gulf of Suez. And then as that goes up, that becomes the Suez Canal, controlled by Egypt. And then it empties into the top there at the Mediterranean Sea. So the top water blob is the Mediterranean Sea, which of course gets you to, you know, Turkey and Libya and Morocco and, you know, the Western European countries and so on. Whereas the bottom here, the Red Sea, that gets you, if you keep sailing south and then to the east, you get to the Persian Gulf. And, you know, you get to the Middle Eastern countries and eventually on over to India and so on. Okay, so the left rabbit ear, again, that goes to the Suez Canal. The right rabbit ear is that ends right where Israel begins. Actually, Israel shares, there's a river there, and Israel shares a border with Jordan right there. So Jordan's on the right, Israel's on the left. And what's in between the two rabbit ears? That's the Sinai Peninsula, by the way. That whole thing is the Sinai Peninsula, which is mostly desert. All right, so the right rabbit ear, what they want to do is they want to cut this canal from the right rabbit ear, like up and to the left across Israel into the Mediterranean Sea. So that's what the geography looks like on this. It's also noteworthy, by the way, if you just look at this map and you can see the areas up in the northern part of the map that are more green. That's where the climate's better for growing food. Those are the areas of food abundance. And you can see in northern Egypt, a lot of food abundance up there. And also, of course, in parts of Israel there, especially the western half and the northern parts of Israel. It's got a lot of green. And that's one of the reasons that this geography is so valuable. But also, the land of Israel is, you know, it's this gateway from Africa to the Middle East, and therefore from Africa also to, you know, the European continent as well, by land, obviously. But that's what makes this geography so valuable throughout history, is it's a gateway piece. Well, anyway, this Ben-Gurion Canal wants to cut across this and then give Israel and the United States control over this key strategic passageway. So I wonder what Jordanians have to say about the idea of 520 nuclear blasts to build this canal. And what does Hezbollah have to say about that? How about Syria? The prevailing winds, I think they tend to blow more to the northeast from there, although I could be wrong. But all the neighboring countries are not going to be happy about fallout from 500 plus nuclear blasts. And by the way, I'm reminded that so much of what happens in politics and economics is rooted in geography. If you want to understand, you know, wars and culture and food supplies, transportation, and all that, you need to understand the geography. In fact, it's the geography of America that has made America so powerful and abundant for all these years. I mean, really, the United States of America has extraordinary geography. You know, one coastline on the Atlantic, another coastline on the Pacific, and mineral-rich, energy-rich rivers for transportation, you know, food supplies, rainfall. It's extraordinary. And frankly, it's, you know, it's a gift from God and Mother Nature that we have this land. And compare what we have to a lot of other lands around the world, and you understand why America has been so abundant since the end of World War II. But then again, you know, American culture has become kind of apathetic and lazy and hyper-privileged. And so, you know, we seem to be kind of losing track of our original founding principles. Well, I've got a lot more to share with you on this, but a couple of notes. I forgot to mention this. Our Black Friday sale event begins this Thursday. It's actually at 11 a.m. Central, and you can see everything we have available. It's a massive collection. You can see it right now. Go to healthrangerstore.com/Black Friday. All one word, no space. Again, healthrangerstore.com /Black Friday, and that's a forward slash Black Friday. You can see it. Amazing. We're going to have a lot of discounts. Got a lot of new products, including my new knife, Escape from LA, finally ready. Will be available starting this Thursday. We only have a small number of those, unfortunately. And this sale event runs Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Yeah, until midnight, Sunday night. But a lot of the items will probably be sold out by the end of day Friday. So take a look. If you want to get something that might be in short supply, take a look now and get ready. It all begins at 11 a.m. Central this Thursday, just 2 days away. Now, today, by the way, depending on when you're hearing this, today is Tuesday, I'm hosting the Alex Jones Show for hours 2 and 3. And I'm slated to have Jeffrey Prather on for the second hour, which is, let's see, that's 12 noon Central Time. And then at 1 p.m. Central, I'm going to have Scott Ritter as a guest. So you can watch all that at Infowars.com or band.video. And I will probably replay those interviews on my own channel page on Brighteon.com as well. Oh, one more thing. Forgot to mention, in our Thursday Black Friday event, well, which begins Thursday, the Pine Needle Nasal Spray that I mentioned, that is very limited supply. We're giving it away free for to any customer who places an order over $150. You get this pine needle nasal spray, but it's also made with colloidal silver. So it's actually a pine needle colloidal silver nasal spray. And these are the pine needles from the loblolly pine trees in Central Texas. I harvested them myself. Like, literally went out and harvested these and then oversaw the, you know, the cleaning and the grinding and the extraction to get the shikimic acid out, and also the vitamin C that naturally occurs in pine needles. And I drank a lot of that pine needle tea, actually. It's quite delicious, so I had a good time. But if you want to get your hands on some of that pine needle nasal spray with colloidal silver in it, then just place an order with us beginning, you know, this, like I said, this Thursday at 11 a.m. Central. All right, also, I have posted an interview now with Michael Yan as part of our Decentralized TV interview series. That is posted on decentralized.tv as well as my channel on brighteon.com. And that's a recent interview with Michael Yan that we just filmed last week. And we did that with Michael in Belize. I mean, he was in Belize, and he was talking to the Mennonites there. And the Mennonite groups are living off-grid. You know, Mennonites do not rely on technology. They live a very self-reliant or self-sustaining lifestyle. They use medicinal herbs. You know, they're very committed to their faith, very much so. They spend a lot of time studying scripture and teaching scripture to the children and so on. And the children are highly intelligent, highly capable, you know, hands-on at a very young age. The Mennonites don't have problems with kids committing suicide. They don't have transgenderism, mental illness, none of that stuff. They don't have kids on antidepressants, you know, and psychiatric drugs or mass shooters, nothing like that. The Mennonites have a lot of things figured out, and there are hundreds of them living in this community in Belize. And so Michael Yan was visiting them, and he gives us a report about that, but also the much bigger picture of, you know, where can you find freedom in the world? Where can you live where the government doesn't coerce you into everything, like taking vaccines, you know? Where can you go? Well, Michael Yan helps answer that in our interview. So it's a great interview. Check it out. Again, it's on decentralized.tv as well as brighteon.com. Now, getting back to the Ben-Gurion Canal project and how that might be an explanation for some of what's happening right now in the Middle East. There are 90 doctors that have now signed a letter. These are Israeli doctors. They have signed a letter. It's 90 or 100, somewhere around 90. They've signed a letter urging the IDF to bomb hospitals in Gaza. I mean, this is the craziest thing I've ever seen from the world of medicine. Well, okay, maybe not the craziest, because I have seen reports of doctors murdering patients in America with ventilators. That's crazy. But this is also pretty crazy. So the headline from MondoWeiss.net is Israeli doctors urge the bombing of Gaza hospitals. Right. And this was also covered by InformationLiberation.com. And there it states, dozens of prominent Israeli rabbis have assured Israeli leaders that they have a right to bomb the Al-Shifa hospital in Gaza. And this week's letter, signed by Doctors for the Rights of IDF Soldiers, that's the name of the group, urges the bombing of every hospital in Gaza. The letter states, in no uncertain terms, that due to suspicion of terrorist activity, the hospitals are, quote, a legitimate target for annihilation. Wow. They claim that ambulances that are evacuating patients to the south in order to be treated elsewhere are at their disposal. And, of course, these ambulances are being bombed by Israel. I mean, there are over 100 ambulances that have been bombed and hundreds of medical workers murdered, just straight up killed. Let's see. The doctors claim that the residents of Gaza are the ones who brought their annihilation upon themselves. And this, of course, echoes the genocidal rhetoric of centrist Israeli politicians who have claimed that the children of Gaza have brought this upon themselves. The doctors apply the terms snakes, wasps, and terrorist nests. I'm hearing wasp is a kind of a racial slur against Palestinians. Have you heard that term being used? It's kind of like, I guess it's kind of like the N-word used against Palestinians, to call them wasps. So, of course, Israelis are dehumanizing Palestinians. Let's see. The original letter was signed by 9 Israeli doctors, including gynecologists and pediatricians. How can you be a doctor who treats children and then you say, let's go bomb other children? I mean, seriously, these are some sick, twisted people. Anyway, it was signed by 9 doctors, and then at least another 83 added their signatures, and that's been published at various websites since then. So now it's up to 90 doctors that are urging the bombing of hospitals. Now, remember when I said yesterday that this is designed to provoke the Arab nations? So you're going to see the atrocities get more and more insane. You know, to the point where you're going to be like, what are they thinking? What on earth? Why would doctors sign a letter to bomb hospitals and even pediatricians? Why would they sign letters to bomb hospitals and kill children and bomb ambulances and so on? And the answer is because they are trying to provoke the Arab nations, or Iran in particular, Persia. They're trying to provoke Iran into bombing Israel for reasons that, you know, we covered yesterday. But clearly this is being designed to provoke. Now, I have a question for you. There are hospitals in New York City, right? Now, here's a question for you. You could ask this to anybody who is currently, quote, standing with Israel as Israel is bombing hospitals. If terrorists were hiding out in New York City, would it be justifiable to bomb New York City? If terrorists in New York City were believed to be hiding in hospitals in New York City, would it be okay to bomb New York City hospitals? You know, just carpet bomb the whole city, carpet bomb the hospitals, bomb the ambulances, bomb the refugee camps, whatever. Would that be justifiable? Because if there's anybody out there who's saying, well, it's perfectly fine to bomb hospitals and universities and mosques and refugee camps in Gaza, well, then, you know, first of all, that person would be completely clinically insane in order to have arrived at such a conclusion. But then they would have to apply that to New York City or other cities as well. I guess they would agree with bombing any city if there were some terrorists running around. Bomb them all. And some Israelis have an excuse. Well, you know, we told them to leave. It's their fault that they stuck around. Would it be okay then, the next question, would it be okay to bomb New York City into rubble if you had first told New Yorkers to leave? Would that make it okay? It's like, okay, we dropped leaflets over the city, you know? We told them to get out. They didn't get out. We bombed them, you know? It's not our fault. They're all complicit. They're hiding the terrorists in the hospitals, you know? What if, here's another question. What if New York City residents were warned to leave, but then all the bridges were bombed? So, like, you couldn't get off of Manhattan. Like, you're stuck. You're stuck in the city. The streets are turned to rubble. The bridges are all bombed out. You know, all the ferries are bombed and everything. You can't leave. And then somebody carpet bombs New York City. Would that be okay also? Would that be justifiable? Because that's what Netanyahu believes. He thinks that's justifiable. So do the people who, quote, stand with Israel, you know, like Ben Shapiro and so on. He probably wouldn't have any problem with bombing New York City as long as there were some Hamas people running around. I guess at this point, you could just take a few Hamas people and have them make appearances in whatever city you wanted bombed. Like, let's say if you hate Chicago and you just want to bomb Chicago, you just have a few Hamas people show up there. Look, Hamas in Chicago. And then apparently the U.S. will send aircraft carriers. Well, maybe they can't get those to Chicago, but they'll send B-2 bombers. They'll send, you know, all kinds of military assets in order to carpet bomb probably Chicago just because there were some terrorists somewhere in the city. Well, we sure showed them. You know, we have to be safe. We have a right to defend ourselves against the terrorists, so that's why we bombed Chicago. I mean, this is the logic of the Israeli people right now, the Zionist people. I mean, they're truly insane. But for doctors to be recommending this, doesn't that just, you know, double down on how modern Western medicine has lost its mind and lost its morals? I mean, rabbi doctors, they're supposed to be loyal to the teachings of God, and yet they say, yeah, let's just bomb other hospitals full of civilians. It's okay, because there might be terrorists in there. Bomb cancer patients, bomb, you know, heart patients. Wow. That's Zionism for you right there. By the way, there's been a protest against Boeing in the United States, in Missouri, because Boeing reportedly has expedited the shipment of 1,000 precision-guided munitions to Israel. And Middle East Eye is reporting this. Activists blocked Boeing facility supplying bombs to Israel. So the activists obstructed an entry point to Building 598 at Boeing in Missouri, where production takes place for the bombs and ammunition used by Israel in Gaza. So this plant in Missouri is responsible for supplying 1,000 bombs, which includes small diameter bombs and joint direct attack munitions, those JDAMs, to Israel. And Boeing expedited the shipment after October 7th. Bloomberg reported this on October 10. And let's see, the 250-pound bombs were transported to Israel aboard Israeli Air Force planes from a U.S. Air Force base. So, Boeing is also bombing hospitals. I mean, I guess the rabbis would support this. Boeing is bombing hospitals. Boeing's bombs, to state it correctly, Boeing's bombs are bombing hospitals, bombing ambulances, bombing refugees, refugee camps, mosques, universities. I mean, what's not to like? I mean, next time you get on a flight and it's a Boeing jet, you know, you can feel good about the genocide that Boeing is carrying out against the Palestinians. You know, feel good about that. You know, you're sitting on a 737, you know, in your comfortable cabin air. It's like, yeah, this feels pretty good in here. Much better than the people receiving Boeing bombs. People in hospitals who are having the rubble fall on their heads and mothers searching the rubble for their missing children and only finding torn limbs. Thank you, Boeing. Thank you, Boeing, for giving us more horrors in our world. So let's see, the groups that staged this protest in front of Boeing were the St. Louis Palestine Solidarity Committee, another group called Black Men Build St. Louis, and then the Boeing Arms Genocide Campaign, and also Resist St. Louis. That's an odd name. Why do you want to resist St. Louis? I don't know. What's wrong with St. Louis? But I'm wondering why they bothered shipping the bombs to Israel when apparently, you know, Boeing could soon be bombing New York City hospitals because there might be Hamas in New York City, as I just mentioned. Maybe they should keep the bombs here because you never know where Hamas might pop up. Hamas could appear in a football stadium and Boeing would need to bomb the football stadium, right? Or a mall or a grocery store. There could be Hamas buying groceries, you know. They might be buying hummus or something and Boeing would need to come along with, bomb them grocery stores. Might be Hamas in there. And remember, if anybody says, well, you can't bomb grocery stores filled with innocent civilians, all you have to say is what Israel says. Oh, they're being used as human shields. When we bomb and kill them, it's the fault of Hamas. It's not our fault. It's Hamas's fault. Hamas was in there buying hummus, which is concerningly close to the pronunciation of Hamas. But the point is, nobody could complain when innocent civilians get bombed, murdered, and slaughtered, and their limbs are all blown apart. You say, well, hey, that's Hamas's fault. We had to bomb the entire store, you know, whatever. Now, obviously, for the record, I am mocking the sick, twisted sociopaths who are justifying the bombing of civilians in Gaza. I am mocking them by I'm trying to show how insane their ideas are. Because again, if that's okay, then you could justify bombing hospitals, you know, in Seattle or anywhere. Just, I guess, Boeing bombs and U.S. military bombers just fly over all of America's cities, bomb them all. There might be Hamas in there somewhere. We don't know. Could be. I mean, the level of intolerance and racism and violence and genocide is just off the charts. It's insane. In fact, I wanted to just comment on this. You know, there's been a lot of buzz on social media and the Western press about the release of the first three pages of this trans manifesto. This was the trans shooter, a female to male transgender who shot up this Christian school, I don't know, a few months back and killed several, you know, innocent young students and some staff members at the school. And apparently, Steven Crowder got a hold of the first three pages of this trans manifesto. And these three pages have been released to the public. And it's just got, you know, handwriting like a journal of this person, this trans person, who is filled with anti-white hatred. And here's an entry from February 3rd. And it says, and I mean, I almost hate to say these words, but it's important to understand this. And also, I have some comments on this. But it starts off, it says, kill those kids. It says, those crackers going to private fancy schools with those fancy quackies and sports backpacks. I think she means khakis, but she didn't know how to spell khakis. So she spelled quackies. With their daddy's Mustangs and convertibles. F you little bleeps. I wish to shoot your weak ass D's with your mop yellow hair. Wanna kill all you little crackers. Bunch of little faggots with your white privilege. You couldn't even spell privilege correctly. With your white privileges. F you faggots. And that, like, that's, so that's one page, one little sample of what's in this. And everybody's losing their minds over this. I'm wondering, why? Why exactly? Why is everybody losing their minds over this? I mean, number one, like, that's kind of every other comment on Reddit right there is all anti-white, you know, woke, hate-filled vitriol against white people. But in the context of what's happening in the Middle East, this is nothing. I mean, yeah, so a trans person goes in and kills, I think it's six people. I might be wrong. It's something, it's under 10, I believe. And, it's not inconsequential. Every life does matter. And I don't mean to minimize the loss of life that happened there, but in the context of 10,000 Palestinians have been bombed to death by companies like Boeing that are still listed on the U.S. stock exchange. I mean, 10,000 people dead versus 10. You know, 1,000 times more deaths have happened in Gaza. And yet everybody's losing their minds over this trans manifesto. I don't think there's anything surprising in this trans manifesto. I guess the real story here is that this was covered up for so long. You know, the FBI covered it up and the police covered it up and they refused to release this because it doesn't fit the narrative of the race war in America, where it's all supposed to be, you know, anti-black, essentially. You know, all the shooters are supposed to be angry white people shooting up black churches, for example, which has happened. But so this is the opposite narrative. Well, sort of. I mean, it's anti-white hatred by a radical leftist, obviously a transgender, you know, fully woke, fully indoctrinated, brainwashed leftist who hates white people and hates herself, probably, obviously, you know, is very suicidal. There's another page where she writes, Death Day, what is this, March 27th, today is the day, it has finally come, I can't believe it's here, don't know how I was able to get this far, but here I am, and she writes, I can't believe I'm ready, that I'm doing this, but I'm ready, and then she says, I hope my victims aren't, right, and then she signs it off, ready to die, ha ha, blah. And it's just... Oh, and she writes, she writes that she hopes she has a high death count. Okay, so clearly, you know, premeditated murderer trying to, you know, carry out as much violence as possible. But again, I am not surprised by any of this. This is exactly what schools are teaching kids. This is, you know, left-wing Marxism. This is anti-white hatred. This is a critical race theory, you know. This is... frankly, part of the LGBT agenda is to teach people to hate themselves and also to hate white people in particular. And this is also, you know, Black Lives Matter teaches pretty much the same thing. And this is all, I mean, think about the big picture here. This is just the big agenda, divide and conquer. This is to get people to hate other people, which is what we fight against here on this broadcast and on my platforms. You know, we teach principles of humanity that... we're all human, regardless of our color, regardless of our gender, regardless of our religion or country of origin or how we speak or whatever. We're all human, and as a result, we're all children of God. We all have value, and we should learn to get along with each other. For those who haven't figured that out yet, actually, I can get along with almost anybody. And so can Michael Young, by the way. He can go anywhere in the world and get along with just about anybody. Different religions, different races, different languages, doesn't matter. I'm the same way. You know, I've lived in different countries and traveled quite a lot around the world, and I've never had difficulty getting along with different people from all over the world. But what the globalists are teaching is, of course, divide and conquer. They want you to hate. They are, I mean, the media is a psyop. They're pushing racial hatred constantly. I mean, that was the whole point of the George Floyd story or the Trayvon Martin story under Obama. It was all about pushing racial hatred and specifically trying to lay the blame on white people. So that's what this manifesto, the reason it was covered up is because it counters the narrative that all white people are the ones harming minorities. And instead, this was a shooter that sought out Christian white kids. So again, I'm not surprised at all. And by the way, kind of related to this, I understand from reading the news that Jewish students at universities across America are being hit with a lot of, you know, harassment. You know, they're being spat upon and verbally admonished for being Jewish. And I do want to say for the record, I completely oppose, obviously, treating Jewish students in universities across America with any kind of disrespect like that for a couple of reasons. Number one, First of all, most Jewish Americans, especially the younger ones in the universities, they oppose the bombing of civilians in Gaza. Just because they're Jewish doesn't mean that they're part of the Zionist Netanyahu IDF agenda that is genocidal. You know, again, just because you're a Jew in America does not make you part of that whole operation. Most Jews oppose it, especially most younger Jews. Secondly, even if there were students at universities who supported this bombing campaign of hospitals and, you know, universities, whatever, they have the right to speak their mind. They have the right to hold their views. And if you really want to expose that, don't bully the Jewish students. Instead, put a microphone in front of them and ask them a question. Hey, do you support bombing hospitals in Gaza? And let them tell you how racist they are, if they are, and then post that, tweet that out. You know, that would be far more effective than, you know, bullying or intimidating anybody. Just let them show how racist they are, if indeed they are. But you're going to find that most of them are not. In fact, you're going to find, if people would just realize, man, the manipulation of divide and conquer, it's such a big psyop. They try to get everybody to hate everybody else. If we could set down the hatred or pause the hatred for a little bit and just talk to each other as human beings, you would realize that most people actually don't inherently hate other people. Most whites don't hate blacks, for example. You know, now you might say, well, the Israelis and the Palestinians absolutely do hate each other. Well, perhaps in their groups they do, but I guarantee you, if you took a Palestinian and a Jew, two young students out of a university, and you took them out of their crowds and away from the protests and just in a room together to start talking with each other, like, what are your dreams in life? What do you want to accomplish? You know, what do you value about being alive? You would find that they have a lot in common, and they would find that too. But it's the tribalism when you get with your group and you're waving the flag and you're like, you know, it's us or them, you know, and like, kill them all that kind of stuff. That's when it all gets out of hand. People, they like to play along with the tribalism, but that's all an engineered manipulation by the powers that be. They want to take you out of your individuality and make you part of a mob, and then they want to manipulate the mob to carry out, you know, genocide or hatred or escalation against a different tribe, a different mob. It's all about mob manipulation. And the sooner we all figure that out, the sooner we can reject the mob manipulation and begin to live as individuals who can think for ourselves. You'll notice, for example, that in all my criticism of what the Zionists are doing right now in Gaza, I've never once said that I wanted any harm to be brought to any Israeli or to any Zionist or to any Jew. I have never said that, and I would never say that. It's not my philosophy. I want peace for Jews, just as I want peace for Gazans and Palestinians. I want people to be able to live together in peace. I want to stop the bombing. I want to stop the suffering. And we should also yank the licenses of all those doctors that signed that letter to bomb hospitals in Gaza, because that's completely insane. I want to help support and promote ideas that cause healing. I want to promote, you know, natural medicine, alternative medicine, which is why I do that. I want to promote nutrition. I want to promote critical thinking. I want to promote complementary medicine or natural medicine doctors, naturopaths, Chinese medicine doctors, you know, the healing arts, people that help others heal, because our world needs healing. And if you think about it, the reason that there's so much violence and hatred in the world is all a manipulation from the top. It's not organic. It's not a natural, organic, grassroots movement of hatred. No, it's hatred from the top down. Hatred is pushed from the top down through the media, through the bombings, through the militaries, through the governments, top down. And you're a fool if you go along with it, because you're just being manipulated. Think for yourself, reject the hatred, don't become a bully. And if you encounter someone who is a bully, put a microphone in front of them, hit record, and ask them some questions. Hey, why do you think it's okay to blow up babies that are a different skin color than you? Tell me, please, where the world wants to know. And then post that video on Brighteon.com. Seriously. The best way to get back at racists is to just expose them. Let them explain their racism, or try to, you know. Let their words condemn them themselves, you know. Let their ideas condemn them. Because when they speak and the world hears what they have to say, like, yeah, we should bomb all the hospitals in Gaza. And when they're saying it, they don't realize how crazy it sounds. And then it gets posted online and people are like, what did he just say? What kind of lunatic is this? That's powerful. You want to stop racism? Expose the idiocy of racism. You want to stop violence? Hey, expose how stupid it is to engage in violence against other people. That's the answer. I mean, shed light on it. Transparency, man. But it's also a little bit hilarious to me how the Jewish communities are now complaining about how, you know, Jewish students are being bullied and so on. What about the bullying that white kids have endured through all the critical race theory over all these years? You know, I thought we had decided as a nation that it's wrong to bully people and guilt trip children based on their skin color. It was wrong when America did it culturally to black people. It was wrong. Civil rights movement answered that question. It's also wrong to do it to white kids. And it's wrong to do it to Jewish kids. You know, it's always wrong. I don't know why this is a difficult concept. It's like I shared this story earlier when I was in the fourth or fifth grade, because I was, you know, so bored in school and so far ahead of almost all the other students academically. It's just one of the gifts God gave me. My teacher said, look, you take this time and you tutor this new immigrant who happened to be from Iran. And so I tutored him. And I still recall his first name. I'm probably not going to mention it, but I remember his first name. And I taught that kid. He didn't speak any English at all. I taught that kid his first words in English. And I was, you know, the teacher gave me permission to take time out of the class and just tutor this kid. And I did. And never was I thinking, oh my God, he might be, you know, Hezbollah. He might be wearing a suicide vest. You know, he might be a terrorist. No, it was just like, hey, here's a kid who doesn't know how to read or write or speak any English, and I got to get him up to speed so he can go to school. So I taught him his first words, really. And I don't know how it was, because, you know, I grew up in the Midwest, but we had students from all over the world. We had people from probably the Soviet Union. We had a kid from Korea. We had South Pacific Islanders. You know, we had, of course, Mexican kids and South American kids. We had a kid from Guatemala. We had the Filipinos. We had all kinds of Europeans. A French guy showed up one time. I mean, it was, I don't know if your school was like that, but my school was very international in terms of the students that we had. Maybe it was their parents had all decided, like, this was a great, you know, nice town to come to in the Midwest, and they all showed up, and we had this very multicultural school system, public school. You know, I didn't go to some, you know, rich white kid country club school or anything like that. I grew up in a school with people from all over the world. It was always normal to me. Did I mention, lots of black kids in the school as well, some Indian kids. I mean, like Indian, probably some Native Americans too. I just didn't realize it at the time. It was just completely normal. There was nothing odd about it. And my school never taught me hatred. You know, thank God. This was long before woke, you know. The school system I went to never said white kids are bad or black kids are bad, or never taught hate or anything. And of course, wasn't trying to mutilate the genitalia of children either, or drug children either. So, you know, sadly, today's society it's a predator society targeting children, and they push hatred. It's part of the agenda to push the hatred, because hatred can be manipulated by the powers that be to control people and to cause, you know, terrorism and crisis and wars and all the things that benefit government power. That's what it is about. So let me leave you with these kind of rules of thumb. It's easy to get your brain all clouded with all the news and all the interpretations and all the psyops, right? And also all the scripture or the interpretations of scriptures, like, you know, 1,000 different pastors that have 1,000 different interpretations, and why over here, why it's okay to bomb these children over here, but it's not over there, and God said this, and you're the chosen ones and all that. Let me just wipe the slate here and make it really simple. It's always wrong to promote the slaughter of people. It's always wrong to carry out genocide and ethnic cleansing. It's wrong to target people because of who they are. There are, of course, cases of eminent self-defense that are legally and morally justifiable. Like, you know, someone's carjacking you and they have a gun in your face, you can defend yourself, right? Or someone's invading your home, you can defend yourself. Or even as a nation, if someone's attacking your nation, you can defend your nation against another nation. But it's always wrong to kill people for who they are, right? Just to say, oh, we don't like this group, fill in the blank, whatever they are, and to say, let's bomb them and destroy their cities and wipe them out and just cleanse the planet of these people. That's always wrong. It's also always wrong to hold hatred in your heart, because more often than not, that hatred has been manipulated. It's been implanted in you through a psyop. And if you find yourself feeling a sense of hatred, check yourself. Check yourself carefully, because you've probably been manipulated into that hatred. And there's a desire on the powers that be to try to get you to act out on that. They want you to snap, you know, they want you to go crazy and go shoot up whatever group they taught you to hate. This is why I even warned people, even during COVID and all the vaccine mandates and everything, I warned people, you know, don't go crazy, don't go shooting up hospitals or vaccine injection clinics or sites, you know, vaccine sites or whatever. I mean, come on. We have to be anti-violence here. Otherwise, we've lost our humanity. So if you feel a sense of hatred towards a group, towards a religion, towards a group of people, an ethnicity, be very careful the path you're going down. Or if you feel hatred, be very, very careful. All throughout history, the globalists have found that the easiest thing to do, the easiest way to control humanity, is to whip people up into a hate-filled fervor, a kind of fanaticism that then motivates them to carry out acts that escalate situations necessitating government intervention or government surveillance or martial law or what have you. So the way that we actually protect our liberty is by maintaining peace. When people aren't shooting each other up, the police state can't justify its power and surveillance as easily. Understand that. When nations aren't fighting each other, the weapons industry can't justify all of its power and profits and manufacturing of bombs, like what Boeing does. The more we have peace, the more power we strip away from the governments and the tyrants, the authoritarians, and also the corporations. So above all else, if you're confused by scripture and the tribulation and the rapture, and if you're confused by the news, I don't know which side to be on, you know, if it's all confusing, just remember, if you want to live in peace, practice peace. If you want to be free, practice de-escalation. Take away power from the governments and the regimes of the world by promoting peace and abundance and understanding and universal tolerance. On the other hand, if you want to be enslaved and surveilled and maybe living in World War III, then go ahead and push for bombings and escalations, and the military is like, build more bombs, you know? I mean, go ahead. If that's the world you want to live in, you can push for that, and it's going to be a living hell. And you might die in that world, too. You might get bombed. Who knows? You might get blown up in a terrorist incident, or maybe Israel decides to bomb New York City, like we said earlier. Who knows? If you want to die with violence, then preach violence. But on the other hand, if you want to live in peace, preach peace. I mean, I know it's almost a worn-out quote, but Gandhi said, you know, be the change you want to see in the world. I'm saying the same thing in a different way here. You want to live in peace? Practice peace. Promote peace. Call for peace. Now, the survival side of me says, and prepare for war. You know, prepare for things to go off the rails, because there's a lot of people in charge of a lot of things who are themselves not invested in peace. They want war. They want conflict, obviously. So prepare for that, but don't yourself get caught up in it. Don't become a vector, a mechanism, a puppet through which war is escalated and human suffering is worsened. Preach peace even if the bombs are falling around you. Seriously. Preach peace and tolerance even if you're living in the middle of a race war. In fact, that's the time when it counts the most. That's the time when God is watching you the most. I mean, anybody can be peaceful when everything's peaceful. Oh, it's so peaceful. We're having a picnic. It's awesome. Let's go have like miniature golf. You feel peaceful. It's hard to be peaceful when bombs are falling around you and people are dying and everybody's calling to slit everybody else's throats. At that moment, to call for peace almost makes you, you know, a heretic. It will get you called out. It will get you banned. But that's when it counts the most. And that time is right now. So in the interest of preparing for things to go off the rails, I do want to give credit to my sponsors today. Then we'll jump into the interview here with Michael Yon. Satellite Phone Store, of course, as you know, SAT123.com. They also run BeReady123.com, which provides solar-powered, you know, solar generators, backup energy, lithium devices with charge controllers and inverters that can help you function even when the power grid is down. And when you combine that with a satellite phone, then you have off-grid satellite communications. So check them out at BeReady123.com or SAT123.com. And if you're looking at gold and silver as a store of value during uncertain times, check out the Treasure Island Company, metalswithmike.com, physical gold and silver in your hands. And I'm surprised that things haven't escalated more quickly in the Middle East, but it's good news if you're looking at acquiring physical gold and silver, because the prices have not yet gone insane. They probably will, although I don't encourage speculation, by the way. You know, do your own research and understand that prices can go up or down. I don't encourage speculation, but it's a reality that if we get into an accelerated World War III, then you can bet that gold and silver and oil are all going to substantially increase in price. And that's not a scenario I wish for, but it is. Having the metals in your hand is a way to insulate yourself from a loss of, you know, bank accounts, from more bank failures. You know, another bank failed last Friday. The sixth bank failure this year, just gone. I said there are going to be more bank failures. Here we go. It's already happened, and there will probably still be more. But as insurance against the collapsing dollar or failing banks, gold and silver make a lot of sense. So do your own research, get your own investment advice, obviously, and understand that prices can be volatile. But I consider physical metals to be, you know, real money, whereas fiat currency to me is just counterfeit fake money that's only temporary. So check out metalswithmike.com. And then don't forget about our Black Friday event happening Thursday, 11 a.m. Central, healthrangerstore.com/Black Friday. It's going to be our biggest sale event of the year with a lot of new products. And you can go look at the catalog right now at that URL, healthrangerstore.com/Black Friday. Check it out. All right, enjoy this partial interview now with Michael Yon. This interview was conducted late last week. My co-host on Decentralized TV, Todd Pittner, he and I conducted the interview. I'm going to play a partial interview for you here. To hear the full interview, you want to check out the DTV or decentralized.tv website, or you can find this interview on my channel on Brighteon.com, and my channel is HR Report. So enjoy this. Hope you learn a lot. And be sure to catch me later today hosting the Alex Jones Show with Jeffrey Prather and Scott Ritter. It's going to be a day for history, that's for sure. Okay, enjoy this interview. Take care. All right, welcome to today's episode of Decentralize TV. I'm Mike Adams of Brighteon.com. This is a very special episode. You'll find out why in a second here. I'm joined by my co-host, Todd Pittner. Welcome, Todd. Great to have you with us today.
Great seeing you, Mike. Thank you.
Absolutely. And I know you are super happy to meet our special guest today, who is Michael Yan. Welcome, Michael.
Indeed.
Thank you, gentlemen. I'm in Belize today, right next to the Crocodile Alley here.
Yeah, every time we interview you, you are in a different country. That I think you have the record for that. But let me give a little background and we'll go right into it. So for our audience, you know, this show is about decentralized living and solutions for being free of, you know, gulags and government oppression and having self-determination. Now, Michael, you are an international war correspondent journalist. You have been traveling the world, sounding the alarm on so many fronts, including about the open border situation in the United States. You get along with people everywhere. You have this amazing knack of getting along with people, whether they're Japanese or Thai or Panamanian or wherever. And so you've seen the world far more than most people. And I want to ask you, sir, to begin with, in terms of decentralized living, and we're going to get to some current events with you too, by the way, because I know a lot's going on in the Middle East and elsewhere, but what have you noticed about the world and what are the safest places versus the most dangerous places in terms of personal liberty and being allowed to live the way you want to live?
Well, that's a moving target because, as you can see, our rights have been eroded in the United States. And I have spent more than half of my life out of the United States, like a lot more than half of my life. Although I'm American, I was born and raised in the United States. It's interesting because here in Belize, I was just talking with some Mennonites, and that's one of the reasons I came to Belize is because I wanted to ask them how they got here, and I heard some of the Mennonites are moving over to Suriname and Peru, and so I wanted to ask them, why did you pick those places, and why are some leaving here, and that sort of thing. And the reason why some of them are leaving here, actually, in Belize is because Belize tried to force everybody to vax, and the Mennonites wouldn't do it. Of course, the Mennonites don't use phones, and that sort of, there's different groups of Mennonites. Some are pretty hardcore, no phones whatsoever. And in fact, I heard a story the other day about one of the Mennonites. He got caught with a phone, and he got excommunicated, so he's not part of the community anymore.
Whoa.
And and sometimes when Mennonites do something wrong, they make them go. The other Mennonites make them go barefoot for a period of time, things like that. But they're very friendly. They're known here in Belize as being very honest, punctual, which is, you know, not something you find in Central America much. But except by the
you don't have to tell
Mennonites.
Me. I lived there before. Yeah.
Oh man. Oh yeah. So I was talking with the Mennonites. It was a good time, you know. And I always get along with farmers, and they're farmers. It's farmers that I get along with in every single country. It doesn't matter culture or religion or what. I mean, I got along with Taliban farmers. I mean, at some point you're just like, wait a minute, why are we bombing these guys? They're just farmers. You know what I mean? They're worried about the rain and stuff like that. You know, and the only reason they're fighting us is because we hit their beehive. I'm talking about the ones that, you know, anyway. Talking with the Mennonites, and I showed them my DSLR camera, and they were like, wow, how does this work? And, you know, and one of them spoke English, and they speak low German, so I could understand some of it. Actually, I was speaking high German to them, and they understood my high German. I didn't understand that, only understand about a third of their low German. But they didn't. I asked if they had a map, and I thought the answer would be no. And they're like, no, we don't have a map. And because they asked me, because they were talking about Peru and Suriname, and they know that part of their community is going there, but they actually didn't know where it was at on a map.
Wow.
It was interesting. Yeah. Because just before we showed up to their shop, I said, you know, I bet they don't know how to read a map, because a lot of people like this actually don't when I'm around the world. They're very smart, but they're very disconnected from the ways that we live. And I think their resilience level is going to be very high, partly because they have a community, and it's very tight community. And they keep things to themselves. And one of the reasons they have some political clout in Belize is because they produce a lot of the food here, right? And everybody trusts them. They just don't cause problems. Sometimes Mennonites get caught smuggling, actually. They're actually known for being smugglers in different countries. Like a Border Patrol friend told me in the United States, he said he used to catch Mennonites pretty frequently smuggling, which is kind of interesting. Anyway, but you know, you never know what you're going to see until you kick the tires. So yeah, so one of the reasons I came to Belize was to talk with the Mennonites about their resilience, because there's a lot to learn from them. I also came to learn more about the migration flows that are going through here. There's a river called the Hondo River between Belize and Mexico, where some of the aliens are going through, Chinese actually, to the United States. But another interesting aspect of Belize that interests me specifically is the close relationship with Taiwan. And Taiwan, for instance, is doing infrastructure projects here and other sort of civil affairs projects. And there's good feelings towards the Taiwanese here. Belize still recognizes Taiwan, whereas most of the world has turned their back on Taiwan for money or whatever reasons. And Guatemala has not either. So Guatemala and Belize, who are neighbors here, have not turned their back on Taiwan. And I'm curious, it seems to me that Taiwan might be doing so much work here in Belize because maybe this is where they see it as another escape hatch. For instance, if Taiwan is attacked, they could make their way to Belize. I don't know if that's the truth, but I brought it up to someone who lives here who said, yeah, everybody knows that. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, sorry. That may very well be a plan. I do know that Taiwan provides a lot of funding for agricultural education in that area. So the Taiwan government gives a lot of grant money to a lot of these countries, including Central American countries. But let me ask you one more related question to all that. And then the next question is for Todd, because he's been watching all your videos and he's got a bunch of questions for you as well. But Michael, given the instability in the world today and the wide open U.S. southern border, and also the potential for civil war in the United States or secession or, you know, a Balkanization, but also really just outrageous instability across Western Europe, as you and I have talked about many times, with the collapse of the industrial base, the collapse of affordable energy, and so on. If someone were watching this today and looking for a different place to move to get out of, let's say, the UK or out of the US or out of Canada even, where would you suggest that people take a look at going, if anywhere? I mean, is there anywhere that is still viable as a place where you can raise a family, grow your food, and largely be left alone, or is that gone?
That's why I wanted to talk with the Mennonites, because I'm that if anybody knows, you know what I mean? Because Mennonites have sort of a meta culture, like many groups do. Like Chinese have these communities all over the world, and they communicate with each other, as do some Jewish and Germans and others. And the Mennonites do that as well. So that's why I specifically, one of the main reasons I came to Belize is just to talk with Mennonites. Why did you pick Peru? Why did you pick Suriname? And are you staying here? Yes, most of them are going to stay here, they said. But they're two groups are splitting off and they talked about, for instance, they're building one of, they call them camps. They're sort of farm groups. They're building one now in Suriname. And so, you know, they're going to go over, I think he said, with 400 to begin with. Wow. But the initial crew is there now. And so it's interesting, too. One of the reasons, again, is that they're splitting off is they refuse to vax. They're like, no. They're like, no way, Jose. And so and then the Belizean government, I'm told, did not try to force them to vax. In the beginning, they tried to, and the Mennonites are like, no, we'll just leave. And then, you know, everybody realizes how important Mennonites are to Belize, and so they have some clout. But in any case, you know, they're farmers, and they deal with their common sense, and that's why I love to talk with farmers all over the world. So let me talk with the Mennonites more, and then I'll tell you what more they tell me, because I'm going to spend more time with them.
Okay.
But yeah, but you know, this is a good place. Belize is a good place for now, especially, I mean, a lot of the very wealthy people have come here. Bill Gates, I'm told, owns an island nearby, and you know, Francis Ford Coppola, just people like that have found homes or second homes here. It is relatively stable for Central America for now. I don't know how things now. Panama, as you know, I just left. Many Americans are like, hey, I'm moving to Panama. It's such a great place. And they ask me all the time, should I move to Panama? And because there's this common knowledge that Panama is stable. And I'm like, there is no chance I would move to Panama long term.
Wow.
It's like, and in fact, right now, as we speak, there's violence in the streets. I'm getting reports hourly from Panama. There's been a big uprising in the last week. Right as I left, as I was heading to the airport, there was street blockages that deal with various matters such as a copper mine contract and some other things. I mean, nominally, it's about the contract with the copper mines, but that's just contributive, actually.
I see.
But Panama is not a long-term plan. Rest assured on that.
Okay. All right. So, Todd, turn it over to you.
Thank you. Michael Yan, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us. Michael Yan, combat correspondent. You have forgotten more about mainstream media than I'll ever know. You state on your website at michaelyan.com that we seek the truth in chaos. Can we focus on your reference to the word we, please? I submit we must be a very small percentage of the world. Why? Because the world is in chaos right now, I think we would all agree, and I do not discern that many people are indeed seeking the truth. Instead, I perceive that most are voluntarily swimming in the quicksand of mainstream media lies. What say you, Michael?
Well, first of all, you have to have a steady personality, and I think maybe that's one reason I like farmers all over the place, because they tend to be conservative people that are not, they don't go crazy over everything. You know what I mean? While everybody's going crazy, they're just like, well, what's going on here? I'm not just going to run with you guys because you're running. You know what I mean? I want to check it out first and go slow. Like, look at Mike Adams, Health Ranger, on with us right now while so many people are crying to do a genocide everybody knows Hamas are terrorists, unless they are Hamas, or maybe they're just LGBTQ guys that have no idea. But most of the people, I think, recognize that Hamas are terrorists. But there's a lot of Americans now and others who are screaming to just wipe out all the people in Gaza. And it takes a steady personality not to just jump on that train, because knowing right. that if you don't jump on that train, you're going to get smashed. And now Mike is getting smashed, and as is Doug McGregor, as are others who are standing up and going, no, I'm not going to help load the trains, you know? And that's the kind of people, I gravitate to. And I think that's I go to farmers.
What percentage of people out there, though, do you think just follow the mainstream narrative, that just take their download from mainstream TV? Is it 60%, 70%, 95%?
Well, you know, that's an age-old question, isn't it? I mean, no, yes. It's not age-old, because we haven't had mainstream media for ages. But now, the fights between, do you watch CNN or Fox? I'm like, well, if you watch either one, you're not somebody I'm going to take advice from. You know what I mean? it's interesting. I call it the beast. It's this amorphous thing that we're facing. They're not omnipotent. The beast is not omnipotent, and it's not omniscient. It is powerful, and it does have a collective intelligence that's quite serious. But if it were omnipotent, we wouldn't be able to talk right now, right? We still have it's not in complete control, and we are slowing it down.
Thankfully.
We are fighting it. I mean, because we are getting our words out, right? And they're trying to knock us down, and they've had some successes, but we've also had some counter attacks that have been successful. And by the way, if you play only defense, you're going to lose. You will absolutely lose. You have to play offensive in this. You can't just go, well, you know, I'll just wait them out. No, if you just wait them out, they're going to burn you out.
You know who plays the best offense in media? Mike Adams. I'm dead serious.
Mike, watching.
You have blazed the trail there to be able to fight back. So thank you,
Skeeter's here. He's also earning some I mean, standing up on this thing that's going on in Gaza right now, that leaves scars. And Mike's getting cut doing this. He's getting cut doing this, but he's also earning respect because he's staying psychologically steady, like not going crazy and just following the masses. Because the people that follow the masses, hey, man, don't do it. The only thing that can happen, you know, good out of that is you don't get trampled that day, but you end up going off the cliff. You didn't get trampled until you hit the bottom of the cliff. You got trampled by the bodies above you. Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, no, let me just jump in. I mean, thank you both for your comments on that. Look, I am a principled person. And anybody who's followed me for any period of time, they know that. And so there was never any question in my mind. This wasn't a difficult choice. There was never a time where I thought, should I go with all the pressure to call for genocide? No, that never entered the equation. It was like genocide is always wrong.
We can't really see that you're principled until you do really have to face something like this.
True.
Which you are now, and you're going into it face mask first. You're just like, bam, okay, this is my principles, and you're sticking to them, and that earns respect.
Yeah.
And hatred as well, as you know.
Yeah, well, that's what the globalists do, is they divide people by religion, by ethnicity, by race, by skin color, whatever, even, you know, by gender. They divide people. And I always keep reminding people to step above all of that and look at it and realize that whether it's Israelis killing Palestinians or Hamas killing Israelis, the globalists are smiling either way. They don't care which tribe is killing which other tribe. They're happy either way. But let's bring us back to some solutions. Let me go with my next question to you, Michael, because you've traveled the world more than almost anybody I know. And I want to ask you about currency and systems of trade and systems of saving money. Now, specifically on this show, we advocate that people take self-custody of their money. And real money is gold and silver. And we talk about privacy crypto like Monero, for example, because governments can't easily confiscate it, things like that. But also real money can be things of barter. As you know, it could be garden seeds. It could be ammunition. It could be land. Clearly, with the farmers, land has value. Water has value. What are you seeing, Michael, around the world? What are you seeing people use as systems of trade and storage of value other than just the regular government-issued paper currency?
Actually, a lot of people are using paper currency now, the people that I'm with. But, you know, when I'm down with the Indians, in Panama and Darien, I mean, they do use money a lot, but they also, you know, trade avocados and things like that. Just normal, you know, old school trade, right? You know, trading chickens for avocados, that sort of thing. But mostly they are actually using money down there.
Paper currency?
They use U.S. dollars in Panama. And here they use U.S. dollars and Belizean dollars. Over in places like Afghanistan, they will trade. One problem with Afghanistan when it comes, and I was just out asking a Belizean woman last night or yesterday about, you know, how they do their weights and measures. Weights and measures are a big deal when you start trading. Like in Afghanistan, I looked into that quite a lot. All these different ethnic groups in Afghanistan, they have different weights and measures. Like for instance, they would trade opium based on the weight of a AA or a AAA battery, which is interesting because AA and AAA batteries weigh. So I checked into that and I'm like, hold on, because all the AA batteries, they don't weigh the same. Like an Alkaline weighs differently. You know? Another way they do it is on the weight of an AK-47 bullet. So, like, for instance, one unit of opium was the weight of an AK-47 bullet. Okay, give me, you know, 30 AK-47 bullets worth of opium or whatever.
Right, but those bullets have different weights, different grains of the bullets.
That's right.
Too.
And
arbitrage opportunity. Thing,
one other thing they do that's more exacting, like, and you go into all the villages and they have the scales. And you see this in a lot of countries, but Afghanistan was really interesting in this. They'll have different water bottles, plastic water bottles, or they can be glass, but they're usually plastic, and they'll be at, you know, different amounts. And these are your units of measures, like your ones and your five. Yeah. And so what they do is they, you know, they somebody comes in with his own water bottle. He knows how much it's supposed to weigh. That's his, you know what I mean? And then the guy that's in that village has his water bottles, and they check. And so they make sure both of them are happy.
Wow.
And And so, but the thing is, it's a lot of us probably take for granted, like, that we have inches and miles and pounds or kilos or whatever that we all agree to, and units of volume as well. But in many parts of the world, that's a problem, you know, because you got all these cultures dealing. So it makes me wonder, as these people come into the United States from all over the world, many of these people, they will not know how to read a map, period. Most of the people in the world that I deal with do not know how to read a map. In fact, that's how I caught one of the North Korean frauds. He was a pretty famous fraud that I caught. He was on 60 Minutes, and he was rambling on about different stuff. And as soon as that show was over, about 15 minutes later, I posted something at great risk to myself. And I said, right, you can find my post online. I posted something like, I'm risking defamation here, but I'm going to say why he's a fraud. And I was doing that to demonstrate that I do know what I'm talking about. He was this guy. There's a book called, like, Escape from Camp 14, I think it's called. And so this North Korean so-called escapee was talking about how he did his escape and all these other things. And when the show, it was only a 15-minute show. When it was over, I was like, he's a fraud based on these things. And one is, he would have had to have known how to read a map. Those guys never know how to read a map. His body language was way off their body. And another thing is he knew his birthday. They never know their birthday. There was quite a few things like that. Like, first of all, the chances that they know how to read a map are like the chances that I can pick up a Mandarin book from 500 years ago and read it, which is like zero, right? And so, and like even the Mennonites, when I just went to see them, they, even though they're moving to Peru and Suriname, the one Mennonite fellow, the main guy I was talking with, he didn't know where they were on a map. And I asked him for a map and they didn't have one. So that's just something to keep in mind as time goes on. A lot of the people that you're going to be dealing with, they have different ideas of, you know, measures of time and everything else. It's quite interesting.
Well, that's fascinating, because you've probably seen these videos. You can go to the streets of different cities in the United States, and you can just stop random people and ask them, like, what continent are we on right now? And they'll say, like, Alaska. You know, I mean, it's the craziest thing. Like, they don't even know what a continent is, much less.
The Mennonite guy said, we showed him on a phone the map, like, this is where Suriname is and stuff, right? And he goes, where are we? And you know, at the blue dot. And he goes, oh, this is where we are. Huh. Yeah. And by the way, that North Korean guy that I called up, what was his name? Kim Il Duke or something. I don't remember. But anyway, he was caught a couple of years later or so, and he admitted to it.
Wow.
He actually admitted.
Well,
he was straight up cop. And all these people, like New York Times and everybody else, were giving him all these huge, huge accolades. He was going around speaking and got some honorary PhD, I think, somewhere. And, you know, best-selling book, like, you know, Escape. I think the guy that wrote the book, his name was Blaine, I think. And I was like, how could you not see that this guy was a fraud? It took me 15 minutes on 60 Minutes to throw 50 red flags on him. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Okay. Todd, you want the next question?
Yeah, I would love it.
Okay. Go for it.
This is just a little bit of curiosity. Michael, where is the place that you have been that you consider the absolute worst hellhole that you would never want to go back to? And where would be the place that you would say is the most heavenly place that if you could be there right now, you'd snap your fingers and would?
Oh, I heard a bunch of noise. It's the rain come here. You can probably see it behind me. Actually, the one place that goes through my mind every single day, you know, this is actually the 94th country that I've actually truly been to. I don't count like airport stops or just a day or two. You know what I mean? Usually I have to be there for a week or so, except for Liechtenstein. Being there for one day can be considered having been to Liechtenstein. It's so small.
For a year.
But India. So what I was getting to by saying this is my 94th country, I actually divide the world into two countries, India and all the rest. It's like, there's two types of travelers, the ones who've been to India and those who have not, you know. And I spent about a year running around India, tracking some cannibals down. That was the funnest time of my life. You know, I was actually studying cults and doing sorts of things. And you know, when I was in Special Forces, some of the old timers, my mentors, I was lucky with that generation of Special Forces old timers. They were the old Vietnam vets and whatnot. And they were hardcore guys, you know, and they would say things like, you know, you need to study world religions and cults. And I'm like, cults? I just want to, you know, jump out of airplanes and blow up bridges or something. You know what I mean? But the many lessons that they taught have stuck with me and been very beneficial. And that got me interested in that anthropological aspect. And at one point I started to realize, based on just their, you know, encouragement to study cults. And I started to realize things like the only cult that people never see is the cult that they're in. Right. And this right, is so very true. Important because because a lot of the fights we see in the world are basically cult on cult fights. Right. And, you know, so how do you define a cult? Yeah. You know, so I was tracking down this cannibal cult and people are like, wow, cannibals still exist. I'm like, yeah. In fact, one was from Houston. His name was Gary Stevenson. It took me 6 months to find him. It was the hardest man hunting I ever did. It was quite dangerous, but I found him. And I found him alive, actually, and interviewed him a lot. He came from a wealthy family in Texas and in Houston, and he was born on December 3rd, 1950 in Houston. His dad was an Army officer in World War II, and I talked with his dad, got old World War II pictures and Papua New Guinea and all this stuff. But in any case, what I'm getting to is he came from a very nice family, wealthy and well-educated, and the next thing you know, he ran off, and he's a cannibal in India, right? And he's a straight-up white guy American, you know? And so it's interesting because people would go, well, why would anybody do that? And I'm like, you know, what about the guys that do the suicide bombings? Or just go, hey, let's run off and do a genocide, you know? I mean, you know, just like it's that group think of just like I'm going to disengage everything that I thought was important and just go, you know, do a suicide bombing or something. Anyway, so bottom line
is, is India your heavenly place or the hell?
Oh no. For me, it's a love and hate. And I'm all my Indian friends, I know some are going to see this. They're going to be messaging me immediately. But I want to go back to India, but to me, it was truly the first and only foreign country I've been to. You know what I mean? I mean, like, truly foreign.
You know? I got you.
And but I enjoyed it. I learned so much. Every day in India is a day in the university of human behavior.
And that's great. That's just the one intersection of traffic, actually. If you can even call it an intersection. Thank you for that answer, and thank you for that question, Todd. Now, I've got a question about a concept that you call, Michael, human osmotic pressure. And you speak about this frequently, which is, of course, masses of humans often moving away from crisis, whether refugees of war or of failed agricultural situations, you know, famine refugees, geopolitical refugees, and so on. I want to ask you here today, two questions about this. In the Middle East, with what's happening right now, where do you see human osmotic pressure, other than obviously Palestinians are being displaced out of Gaza? But beyond that, are there going to be some dynamics of large movements of populations, maybe involving, who knows, Jordan or the West Bank or who knows what? And secondly, what about human osmotic pressure and the United States? Because a lot of people are, for the first time, thinking that maybe living in certain parts of the U.S. is not sustainable, because no one's doing anything about the border. So those are my two questions for you. Human osmotic pressure. And I guess you could talk about Europe if you wish.
Yeah, that human osmotic pressure, the HOP, you know, is the push and the pull of migration. And there's many forms of human osmotic pressure. You know, you may just move across town because it's closer to work, or it's just a nicer place, or maybe it's more affordable, or you suddenly have less money. So there's many things that cause that osmotic pressure. It could be war, pandemic, famine, or just, you know, that's where your family moved to, you know. So there's many pressures, but sometimes they are overwhelming and population size pressures. For instance, and they could be the push or the pull. The push out, the positive pressure, can be a war, right? So people are fleeing from the war. And then the negative pressure is, hey, there's just more money in Switzerland type thing. And so now it's very clear that the United States and others are facilitating invasions of the United States. I want to say that very clearly again. The United States is facilitating the invasion of the United States. It's crystal clear. It's obvious. I'm down here watching it. Our flag is in these camps down in Panama, for instance. A lot of Americans blame Panama. They'll say, oh, sanction Panama or that sort of thing. How are we going to sanction Panama? I mean, the bottom line is we're the ones doing it. In fact, Panama will get sanctioned if they don't go along with it, right? So the fact is the World Economic Forum, the Chinese Communist Party, the United States is part of this gang, is in many countries in the European Union are just caught in this cult. I didn't bring up cults for randomly. Like the World Economic Forum is a clear cult. Okay. Communism is a clear cult. The members of the Chinese Communist Party, that's a straight up cult, right? The cult of the Chinese Communist Party is vital to understand for Americans. And for instance, I think Skeeter's down here. For instance, and not that there's not malaria and dengue here, but the Chinese Communist Party is very important to understand. They look at everybody with Chinese genes as being under their jurisdiction, legal jurisdiction. So in other words, wow. Whether you're Taiwanese and you've been gone for 450 years or since 1950 or whatever, Hong Kong, it doesn't matter if you're Cantonese speaking, Fujianese, it doesn't matter if you've been here in Belize for 100 years or down in Panama for 150 or even 170 years, right? A lot of the Panamanian Chinese, they came originally building the railroads and that sort of thing. So we're talking, you're rolling the clock back 150, 170 years, right? And also building the canal, which would be more like 120-ish, along those lines, right? And so, but the Chinese Communist Party looks at them as Chinese and therefore you owe us, right? Now, take this one step further, the Chinese Communist Party deems that everybody who settled, all the Native Americans, like in Canada, all the way down to Tierra del Fuego, including the Mayans here, actually, they say they came over the land bridge, and the people that settled all of North America, Mexico, and South America are Chinese, so that we stole the land of the Chinese, right? So China is coming back to take, they are teaching their people, go take that land. That's your land, and we're going to go take it. And America is going to be ours, right? So Americans don't realize that. That's what this cult is being taught. And never underestimate the power of a cult, especially when part of the payoff is just utter greed. That's what Stalin did, with the kulaks and that sort of thing. Mao did a similar thing. Go ahead, sir.
Well, no. I don't. Maybe there was a sound or something. But since you paused, I will add. So for those people who think that the biggest conflict about land is Palestine and Israel, the answer is way bigger than that. It's that North America, the Chinese Communist Party believes that they have the right to North America, and that we, Anglo-Saxons, Caucasians, whatever, we are just sort of temporary interlopers onto their land. So for all those people watching, if you think that if you're wondering what it would be like to be displaced from your land, like people in Gaza right now, just stick around a few more years. You're about to find out.
Wow.
Yeah, and as you know, you're in Texas, and a lot of Texans are moving out. It's funny. People saw that I was moving to Texas, not far from you, right? And they're like, "Wow, okay, you're moving to Texas. It must be safe." I'm like, "You followed my work for decades now. You know better. If I move into your neighborhood, you should probably be packing out." Seriously.
No, but I want you as a neighbor, Michael, because I know you're special forces and I have some really good hardware. So all we got to do is get those two things together and we're going to do okay.
Can I discuss the notion of weaponized migration? I know you talk about that a good bit. We can all see weaponized migration with our own eyes, but you also claim, Michael, that foreign armies have infiltrated the United States. And Michael, I personally don't perceive this to be the case. So what's the evidence to back up that claim that we should all be aware of?
Well, you can see, for instance, Chinese Communist Party is coming over every day. I mean, you should see the routes that they've got going through Ecuador now and Colombia. That's just dope. those routes. They're going through Ecuador right as we speak. Their airplanes are coming into Ecuador, into Quito every day. They fill up entire hotels down there in Quito. They get on a bus, they go to different parts of Colombia, or sometimes some of them fly from Quito straight to the United States or to Mexico City and other places, and they either stay in Mexico or they're proceeding to the United States. And keep in mind, I'm often in places like, well, Texas, all over that border, and Yuma, and that's, you know, often San Diego. And I'm talking with the Chinese when they come in, and I'll ask them, the ones who will speak, you know, how did you get here? And many actually have flown from Quito to like Mexico City, and then they, you know, work their way up to Yuma or whatever, right? But the bottom line is the Chinese are coming in large numbers, and those numbers are increasing at a rapid rate. There's two new camps being built in the Darien Gap right now. I just chartered an airplane a couple of weeks ago and flew over those camps after I went on the ground. And, you know, usually I'm on the ground down there, but sometimes I'll charter an aircraft and go fly over them because, you know, it's good to get both views. But they're building two new camps in the Darien Gap, and these camps will be big enough for about 30,000 more people per day.
These are Army members, though? They're not just,
I'm not saying they're all Army people. And keep in mind, when I say, I've never said that armies are coming in. Others may have said that. I'm saying weaponized migration.
But most of them are military-aged men.
True. Clearly. In fact, I can send you some documents that we can't publicize, but I think I sent you one paper from a mutual friend of ours. And you can see most of the Chinese that are signing in and going through these crossings are men. And I just physically see it. I'm down there all the time. Mm-hmm. And so they're mostly men. There are family, what appear to be family units that come through as well. But so you can't get confused with, there's many different ecosystems coming in, right? Okay. And so it's not like they're all, you know, marching together. That's clearly not the case. But there's clearly a lot of, you know, mostly military age men of all sorts, whether it's, you know, Colombians or Venezuela, huge numbers of Venezuelans are coming in. Right now, there's huge numbers of Haitians that used to go through the Darien Gap who are now flying straight to Nicaragua, right? There's articles.
This is all strategic to be able to get them in here. So they're not just people who have escaped, who are looking for a finer life and have dreams of the United States and Hollywood and, you know, rainbows. Well, you don't want our rainbows anymore. So it's not just to live a better life. It's to be able to come in as part of a cult. And I guess, would you call them a sleeper cult, that at some point in time when they're dense enough that they'll be able to make a move?
Well, keep in mind, again, this is a multiplayer game. It's not, and there's many ecosystems of people coming in, right? Okay. It's not like all the Chinese are part of some sleeper system. A lot of them probably are, honestly, just, you know, going to live with their aunt. You know what I mean? That sort of thing. There's different sorts. It, likewise, with the Haitians and whatnot, who seem to be coming in more pell-mell. But the Chinese are very organized, and their system is increasingly organized. They've got like a system within the system, and I see it. I see they've got an actual flow within the flow, right? And some of the other groups are like this as well. Now, weaponized migration, for instance, when I was in Lithuania looking at this before the Russia-Ukraine war, and that's why I was one of the first ones warning something was about to happen. I was down in Morocco watching the flows from Morocco to Spain, the Ceuta and Melilla, actually, two Spanish cities are actually in Northern Africa. And then I flew from there up to Lithuania because the Belarus was pushing aliens over and trying to push them into Poland and also successfully into Lithuania. So I flew up to Lithuania. Luckily, I had been with the Lithuanian army in Afghanistan and I had good contacts. And I flew up there and they gave me access to the camp for about 5 weeks. So I talked with a lot of people there. Now, keep in mind, different groups of people were coming for different reasons. And there were Chechens coming, there were Yazidis and other sorts, and there were Kurds who were not Yazidis, and not to get into the Kurds versus Yazidis thing, but there were many Nigerians and Somalis and that sort of thing. Many of them were flowing through Istanbul. Turkey is one of the pumps. For instance, every day there are flights from Africa through Istanbul that go straight to Bogota, right, every day. So right now, there's people in the air flying from Istanbul to Bogota because it's 7 days a week. And then from there, they go through the Darien or they fly straight to the United States. Now, the difference, Michael, let me say one thing.
Okay.
Let me say one thing. Weaponized migration can be just being there, like the Goths in Rome. In other words, just the mass numbers, right? So there's different ecosystems within this. There are the ones who are just millions and millions of people that don't speak English and don't even know how to use a toilet, at all, literally have never used a toilet. There's a huge numbers of people like that coming in, and they're just unemployable in most businesses, right? And then there are the people that are coming in that are actual spies and actual paramilitary swords.
Thank you, Michael.
Thank you, sir. Thanks, Todd. It's great to come on today.
Absolutely, Michael. Great. All right. Take care. Thank you for supporting us here at Brighteon.com. And one way you can also help support us is by shopping at healthrangerstore.com. And we've got some really exciting new products to share with you here today. I've got samples on my desk, and there's three things to mention here. The one on the left, it's called Hydrate Elementals. It's a combination of coconut water powder, certified organic, and Aquamen, which is a mineral supplement that has some very special, unique properties. This is about mineral replenishment and hydration. You can learn more about it at our website, healthrangerstore.com. It's very popular, especially with people who do any kind of fitness or workouts. We've also got here on the right side a new trail mix product. This has coconut chips and nuts and almonds and walnuts plus raisins. It's a very delicious trail mix, and it's not just a bunch of junk and a bunch of crumbs and byproducts of nut processing. I mean, this is a high-end trail mix, all certified organic, all lab-tested, including for glyphosate and heavy metals and more. Check it out at healthrangerstore.com. You're really going to enjoy this. And then finally, in the middle there, we have something brand new that I'm super excited about. It's a pine needle nasal spray, and that's in the green little small vials there with the nasal spray aerosolized tip on the top. I personally harvested the pine needles for this in Texas. They're loblolly pine trees because the pine needles are extremely high in shikimic acid. And then I oversaw the extraction of the shikimic acid and then the mixing of that into this formula. You can read the ingredients on our website. But this product is not being sold. It's only available for free as a bonus giveaway during our Black Friday sale event that's coming up. And watch for that. Join our email list. You'll get the announcements. You get, all the links to participate in that. The only way that you can get that nasal spray with the shikimic acid using pine needles that I personally harvested in Texas is through the Black Friday event at healthrangerstore.com. And during that event, by the way, it's our biggest sale of the year. We're going to have the most products on discount, all kinds of amazing discounts, including on third-party products that are drop-shipped and so on. It's wait till you see the catalog and the landing page for that. It's going to be quite impressive. But you definitely want to take advantage of that and get some of this pine needle nasal spray. And look up shikimic acid, too, because that's the molecule that is used to make Tamiflu, by the way. Very interesting fact. Also, one more thing. On our website, healthrangerstore.com, we now have available certified organic heavy cream powder. We've got it in pouches and number 10 cans. And this heavy cream powder is, of course, laboratory verified. It's tested for heavy metals and glyphosate and microbiology as well. And there's no junk in here. It's literally powdered heavy cream. It's not just maltodextrin and a bunch of garbage with cream flavor. None of that stuff. This is the real deal. That's why it's not cheap, by the way. But if you want to add to your food storage pantry heavy cream, this goes a long way. And we also have, by the way, we have now organic white cheddar cheese powder, also in number 10 cans and pouches as well. So you can make your own macaroni and cheese pretty easily by combining this cheese powder with the organic cream powder and some salt and pepper and some onion powder and get yourself some, organic macaroni. And it's all done. You have a really nice meal. So take advantage of this at healthrangerstore.com, and that will also help support this platform. We thank you for your support, and I'm committed to bringing you more interviews, more content, more analysis each and every day that helps you understand what's happening in our world, helps you navigate it, and also, importantly, helps you survive it. Thank you for supporting us here at Brighteon.com and healthrangerstore.com. Take care.